Well, welcome again this afternoon. I'm just continually amazed by how many of you come out so faithfully. And I love this song, Fairest Lord Jesus. And Pastor Jesse said it very well when he said, He is not only the Creator, but He's the Savior. And if you think for a moment, God the Father, think about the triune God. God the Father was really the initiator of creation. God the Son was the agent. And God the Holy Spirit was the force behind all of it. So all three, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, the one and only triune God, were involved in creation. And actually, they were involved in salvation as well. Well, let me start off a little casually here. Pastor Jesse said I could dress casually this afternoon, so I tried to do that. I forgot my golf shoes, by the way. But incidentally, I'm not a golfer. If I ever had to golf, you'd have to pay me to golf. I guess different strokes for different folks, but those strokes don't work for me very well. Anyway, thank you for letting me dress down a little bit. I will try to adhere to a little more rigid code tomorrow on the Lord's Day. All right. I know that the material that we cover goes very quickly, but it has to go quickly because there is so much to cover. And please bear with me today. First of all, for the first session, we're going to talk about information, intelligence, and design. The second one will be about the fall, the flood, the fossils, and the facts. And then the last one will be about Charles Darwin, the man behind the monkey. The first two are basically 50-minute segments. I like to keep them to 45, but they're going to go over just a little bit. The last one is shorter, and the last one will be more fun, I think. Well, maybe not fun, but it'll be a little lighter. Information, intelligence, and design. The Beetle convertible. Did it evolve? On its own, by random chance, or was it designed? Well, that's a no-brainer, isn't it? It didn't just pop out of nowhere. Did everything arrive naturally, as in naturalistic evolution? If so, what could be the purpose for nature's beauty and variety? Have you ever stopped to think of why God made roses and all of the lovely plants, lilies, apples, tomatoes, all the other foods we eat, oranges, bananas. What could be the purpose for these? Well, nothing really if you're an evolutionist, just nature and its usual laws and processes. But this outlaws the mind of God, as we all know. Now, just recently, just in August, in World Magazine, there was this article. It said, officials at Indiana's Ball State University announced students would no longer learn about intelligent design. The school's president blasted intelligent design as a discredited theory. Well, I have news for this school president. He needs to get with it. But he's among these kinds of professors. Here's an intelligent design scientist, and here's he's among these professors. Here's an evolutionary scientist, and here's an intelligent design scientist. This may be a Christian, we don't know. But here's an NIH grant, and he's applying for it, and this man says, you're completely free to carry out whatever research you want so long as you come to these conclusions. And, of course, they're evolutionary conclusions. And he himself thinks, there's no bias here. But this poor fellow who is an intelligent design follower says, huh? You know, something doesn't fit here. Collapsing science. Evolutionists should be ashamed of themselves. During the past century, they've had the game pretty much to themselves. They've set the rules, boundaries, the referees, the playing conditions, and just about everything else that matters in science. They've controlled the media, elementary and secondary schools, colleges and universities, the publishing and entertainment world, even mainline churches. Nevertheless, fewer than half of all Americans have bought into the idea that God is extraneous to the process of where everything came from. About half of the people in this country still are creationists. Doesn't it make you wonder what would happen with a level playing field? A game that wasn't rigged? Seeing is believing. Remember the old saying, seeing is believing? Well, yes, seeing can be believing, but evolutionary visionaries can be as blind as cavefish, in my opinion. Not only that, but they see what isn't there, that is undirected naturalistic processes. Have you ever seen an explosion creating anything but a mess? Have you ever seen disorder producing order spontaneously? Have you ever seen complex machinery arriving by chance? Have you ever seen any plant or animal changing into another on its own? Kinds is what I mean. Have you ever seen a transitional fossil, except in evolutionary textbooks, maybe in museums? Have you ever seen undirected naturalistic processes creating anything new and substantive? Well, the more we know about cosmology, biology, chemistry, and so forth, the more we should be able to see that these things simply cannot happen, and they're not happening. So we need to go back to the designer. Ever since Darwin's day, scientists have been luring people away from God, the designer. Today, however, I think we're living in thrilling times because we're being called back to truth. And these, I think, are exciting times for Christians. They can be exciting times, and they should be. Yesterday, I did mention molecular biologist Stephen C. Meyer, who is the director of the Seattle Area Discovery Institute, which is very much an intelligent design organization. An ID theorist, Meyer has ventured out to debate prominent Darwinists on CNN, CPR, Fox, BBC, and so forth. ID proponents are regularly harassed, and he has been harassed. No lion's den, but denials of tenure and media depiction as being anti-science. So in 2009, he was named Daniel of the Year for obvious purposes, because people were picking on him, because he's all for intelligent design. Even at certain Christian colleges and universities denying macroevolution, that is the big kind, not the micro that we can accept, leaves scientists at a risk professionally. Ironically, however, some of today's secular scientists are beginning to back ID, starting with the idea that, in Meyer's words, certain technical features in physical systems reveal the activity of intelligence or a mind. Now, I wish he would go just one step further and say that intelligence can only come from God. The anthropic principle. Anthropic refers to man. The universe seems to be fine-tuned for mankind's benefit. The evidence for design has become so abundant in recent years that secular cosmologists have invented a term called the anthropic principle to explain it away. I'm going to put it up here, but if you understand it, you're better off than I am. The anthropic principle, as they see it, evolution occurred simply because we are. The universe, therefore, only looks as if it was designed, because if it wasn't, we wouldn't be here to observe it. Does that make sense? It makes very little sense to me, except that they don't want a designer, obviously. Design is then nothing more than observer bias. But evidence of design is evidence of design, just like in a VW Beetle, meaning that accidents never created the universe. Now let's compare the atheist versus the agnostic, theistic evolutionist, and a biblical creationist. I put myself in this category, and I think a large proportion of you in this room do as well. The atheist says, here's the basis, no God, bias, 100% biased, result, no creator. The agnostic says, well, I don't know. 100% bias. By the way, I don't care. Why should I care? Theistic evolutionist says Genesis 1 is not literal. It is figurative. 100% bias, and you end up with billions of years. And then the biblical creationist says Genesis 1 is literally true. 100% bias. Yes, I'm 100% biased. Thousands of years, not billions. Now let's look at the perception versus the reality of scientists. Most people think that scientists are always objective. The fact is they are often subjective. People think they are unbiased, but they're often prejudiced. They have their own presuppositions. Infallible? No. Human? Only the facts on the basis of science? No. It's often facts plus opinion, particularly when you talk about origins. Where did we come from? Dressed in white coats versus t-shirts and sandals. Going against the party line. David Berlinski is a non-Christian ally of ID. That's kind of unusual. He's not a Christian, but he believes in intelligent design, nevertheless. Proceeding from a scientific rather than a Christian viewpoint, he sees big holes in Darwinism. It's inadequate as a theory, and I feel very sympathetic, very warm toward intelligent design. I give him credit. He hasn't gotten there all the way, but he's giving it a lot of thought. Anthony Flew, by the way, was a notorious atheist in Great Britain who within recent years has come to see part of the light because of intelligent design. But he still is only a deist. He hasn't gone all the way. But he was a famous atheist. Now, of course, he's being criticized big time for having said intelligent design is rational. We all know that creation started with energy, space, matter, and time. But only three kinds of causes can explain the universe. Necessity, that is, just the laws of nature. Chance, the random assembly of mindless matter. Or intelligent design by an all-knowing creator. Now, you have to go a little further than that. And that's why the book cover of mine says beyond intelligent design. It's not just intelligent design. We have to go all the way to the designer. So let's look at some definitions here. Intelligence is the use of the faculty of reason in solving problems, directing conduct, and so forth. Straight from Webster's dictionary, by the way. It is closely related to information. It implies a rational spirit or mind or being. Design is a pattern of or an outline for planning and carrying out the arrangement of parts, details, form, color, and so forth, so as to produce an artistic or a functional unit, like an airplane or a car. And then biological change mechanisms are pathways for living matter to become something new and different. Well, what is the universe? Naturalistic scientists envision it in terms of energy, matter, space, and time, and of course time has to be measured as billions of years. As they see it, the laws of physics, especially gravity, determine the fate of the universe. Some scientists concede that information plays a role in the universe, yet they reject the logical conclusion that information, for example, in the DNA molecule, implies design, which in turn points to, guess what? A designer. Christians recognize order and design in the universe based on the Creator God who made and upholds all things for His own good purposes. Well, let's think about divine design for a bit. Everywhere we look, we see God's fingerprints. But intelligent design as an intellectual movement does not acknowledge a divine creator, not in and of itself, which is why many Christians disown the ID argument, which I think is a little bit sad because there's something to the ID argument. It just has to be developed all the way to the creator. ID does, however, highlight the problems with random chance and natural selection as engines for upward mobility, serving also as a useful wedge in dislodging Darwinism. Philip Johnson, by the way, an attorney from Berkeley who's written many books, said, "Let's not talk about Christianity, let's talk about dislodging Darwinism." I think he doesn't go far enough. You need to go all the way. If you do, you will end up sounding the death knell for evolution. And you don't do that just by putting in a wedge. The wedge is important, but it's not enough. As any objective observer will admit, mindless matter and purposeless processes never did anything useful, and they can't create a VW. So what makes an airplane fly? Is it the engine? Is it the wing? Is it the fuel tank? Is it the pilot? Well, yes, those are all important. But can any one of these make an airplane fly? No, you have to have them all, and they have to come together at the right time. They have to be coordinated. Why design? Well, an airplane's flight can't be explained in terms of its engines, wings, fuel, or captain. We have to appeal to design, a lot of design in an airplane. Yet many will reject design when dealing with origins. It's okay when you're talking about VWs in airplanes, but not when you're talking about origins. Why? Because they refuse the designer. I keep saying it, but I think that's important to understand. The Creator God, that is. Well, if you're this poor captain, you're not going to go very far, are you? You need all of the pieces in place, including a good fuel tank. Because flight requires information, order, planning, purpose, and a designer. Amazing complexity. If you look at human beings and the DNA that makes us up, the scientific case is very strong for intelligent design, let me tell you. Amazing complexity coming from the Creator God, since evolution could never produce such complexity as DNA, proteins, cilia, and flagella, and we'll talk about these in just a moment. Molecular machines, for example, the cells in a human body. Molecular machines imply irreducible biological complexity. Big words, but I'll make it a little simpler here. We'll talk about a mousetrap. A mousetrap can't function without all of its parts. If you don't have the spring, it's not going to work. If you don't have a little pedal here, you're not going to catch any mice. The thing will not work. It all has to come together at the right time and the right place. That's what we call irreducible biological complexity when it refers to living things. Now, have you ever heard of nanomachines? How many of you have heard of nanomachines? Okay, tiny, tiny, tiny machines. Nanomachines are tiny, tiny machines. They're midgets. Yeah, I suppose you could call them dwarfs. And the reason we know all about nanomachines now is because of the electron microscope. We know that even a single cell is intricately designed. Those of you who have not looked at these two plates out there in the foyer showing a single cell, you want to look at that during the break, how complicated a single cell is. It is amazing, as seen through the electron microscope. Now, what's so great about the electron microscope? Well, it's newer technology. Here's the old light microscope. You have a light source. There you have your specimen, and this is where you have the image. But the electron microscope works just the opposite. Here you have the image, not up there. Here you have the image. And you have a source of power, electrons here, and they go through the machine. And if you think electron microscopes are just small, you can set them on the desk. Well, here's one. It's one of the older models. The important thing is you have a specimen holder. You have an objective lens, an aperture. You have an electron beam coming from above. See, high voltage. And here you have a fluorescent screen, and you can take a picture of that cell and all of its components. They're also called transmission electron microscopes, or TEMs. They use electrons instead of light, and what you can see with a light microscope is limited by the wavelength of the light. TEMs use electrons as a source and a much shorter wavelength, which allows a resolution 1,000 times better than with a light microscope. Now, that's amazing, because take a look at this. This is a rock in your hand, and if you look at that through an electron microscope, it's going to look like Mount Everest, 29,000 feet. That's the kind of resolution you get with an electron microscope, which, by the way, they did not have when I started medical school. Now, bacteria are single-celled organisms, and they usually have just one tail. Here's one that has multiple tails. Sometimes they have more than one. The world's smallest rotary propulsion system is that little tail in one single cell. And if you don't think it's complicated, let's look at it. Cilia and flagella. That tail is called a flagellum. That's a tail. Here's a bacterium. All these little hair-like structures are cilia, and both the tail and the cilia can be used for propulsion. And it's all based on a motor. Cilia and flagella are immensely complex structurally. With electron microscopy, one sees filaments, rods, rings, rotors, hooks, bushings, and so forth, and it sounds like a transmission in an automobile. And that's the way it works, only far more efficiently. For such to exist, the thresholds are so demanding that flagella are the focus of ongoing research. But aside from structure, function is even more complex. For flagella to whip in a meaningful way, like a tail, there must be an acid-driven rotary motor. And that's what it looks like. You have all these structures, and it is amazingly complex. And you can buy DVDs showing how that all works. Biochemical predestination, we'll take a look at this. After 30 years of research on proteins, San Francisco State University of Biochemistry Professor Emeritus Dean Kenyon dismissed his own book, which he had entitled Biochemical Predestination. He'd worked on that all his life. And as he was growing older and about to retire, he dismissed all of his work. The title of the book he had co-authored, well, he admitted there is no biological change mechanism supporting evolution. And what got him to thinking was a student who raised his hand and said, "Professor, I don't think this can work." And he began to think. Proteins are needed to make DNA, but DNA is needed to make proteins. So you have a chicken and egg problem here. Hence the problem of the origin of genetic information. Mind-boggling as it is, you can't get DNA without DNA. Stated differently, dropping Scrabble letters on a table doesn't produce anything readable. But when God is in control, nothing is left to chance. I'm going to ask you to look at a little video here. It's just about 4 minutes. Not even a chicken's egg is left to chance. And let's take a look at a creation video from the Truth Project. We showed one just the other day by Del Tackett and Focus on the Family. It's all about a chicken's egg.
Let's look at the chicken egg for just a minute. Examine it. Learn from it. There are three main parts to the chicken egg. The shell, the yolk, and the egg white. Now, the shell has about 10,000 pores in it. Do you know why those pores are there?
Air in.
To let the air in. That's exactly right, David. Because the chick inside the egg needs that air. There are four vessels that are attached to the chick. Two go to the yolk. That's its food source. Two attach to the outer membrane. For those of you who have ever peeled a hard-boiled egg, you know that there is a membrane around it. That membrane is not there to make the shell come off easier. That membrane is what those two vessels attach to. So when the chick is metabolizing the yolk, it gives off carbon dioxide through those vessels. That goes out between the membrane and the shell. It seeps out through those pores. The oxygen comes in through those pores, down through the vessel, so that the chick can breathe. So the chick is metabolizing the yolk, giving off carbon dioxide, water vapor, breathing air in. The problem is, on the 19th day, the chick is running out of air. It can't get enough air through that vessel. It has a special egg tooth on its beak. The only reason for this egg tooth is to allow the chick to peck a hole in the membrane at one end of the egg, because at one end of the egg, there is an air pocket. Have you noticed on a hard-boiled egg, there's a flat end? That's not so you can set your egg up on the table. There is an air pocket there that gives the chick just enough air, 6 hours of air, for it to peck a hole into the shell, and voila, the chick emerges. Now, isn't that incredible? Ashley, isn't that amazing? My, what you can learn from a chicken egg. Now, of course, we might ask ourselves, how long did it take for the hen to figure that out? I mean, it may have laid an egg that didn't quite have 10,000 pores in it. And the chick dies because of a lack of oxygen, with no ability to give off the carbon dioxide and whatever. If it's too many pores, the shell becomes too brittle. Or maybe it's three vessels instead of four. Or maybe the air pocket's not quite big enough. What an amazing thing. But talk to the animals, and they will teach you and tell you. Now, the chicken egg poses a problem. And that problem is order.
We could go on with that, but we're going to be covering a lot of this anyway. But isn't it amazing? Have you ever stopped to think about a chicken egg and how it manifests the glory of God? Structure. Amazing, isn't it? Birds often lay multiple eggs, so disease, predators, accidents, and so forth do not usually wipe out an entire species. God has built in a redundant system. Lots of eggs. Boys have a higher birth rate, but they are also more likely to die during infancy. They have a higher infant mortality than girls, and that equalizes the ratio of boys and girls in the world. Redundancy and backup systems are built into all nature. We have two eyes, two ears, two lungs, two kidneys, and so forth. Isn't that wonderful? We have a double set. We have two lobes in our brains. The universe and its creatures are an operating digital system. The brain itself is a parallel digital processor acting as an interface with our world. Light and sound are converted into digital bits or bytes sent to the brain over parallel digital cables, the optic and auditory nerves, long before anybody ever invented computers. Long before, and far, far more sophisticated than any computer that man could ever create. Darwinian evolution could never have produced such complexity, not even Bill Gates, but only God himself. Well, is there such a thing as a simple cell? Well, the answer is no, cells are not simple. The adult body has 100 trillion cells. I keep saying that because I hope it sticks in your brain. Babies are born with 10 trillion, but we have 100 trillion. Each like a miniature factory performing all the functions required in our bodies in many different organs. Absorbing, transporting, processing, and utilizing nutrients, eliminating waste products, sustaining themselves and performing useful functions in the body in which they're located, fighting off harmful substances and infections, repairing and reproducing themselves. We call that replication, and it goes on and on and on. Well, the first cell had to do some amazing things. It had to store information, it had to process energy, and it had to reproduce itself. Evolutionists don't know where that first cell came from, nor would they have an idea. Now we're talking about functionality, not just existence of the cell, but how does it function? What does it do? The wonders of the cell. Here's a cell that's duplicating itself. It's dividing into two. We call that cell division, or mitosis. Let's go back here. The Boeing 747. You know how many parts it has? Well, it's right up there, 5 million parts. Is that quite a few parts? In an airplane, it's a lot of parts, isn't it? One single cell has billions of parts. Billions. Does that make you feel small or big? It makes me feel pretty special. In God's eyes. Cellular information. Well, this is where the DNA is located, in the nucleus of the cell. That's DNA. Twisted double helix, we call that. This is the cell. This is the flagellum. We talked about that's the nucleus of the cell. That's a bacterium. Scientists have translated the entire human genome, it has been said. This was the headline of the September 6, 2012 LA Times. In a $123 million effort called ENCODE, which involved more than 400 scientists and some 1,600 experiments over a five-year period of genomic research, this was all done at the European Bioinformatics Institute in England, decoding the human genome. The data strikingly overturns the old idea that the bulk, that is 97% of DNA, is junk. They're finding out that the bulk is functional. DNA has a function. It's not just sitting around as some junk that's left over as an evolutionary residue. Evolutionists claim that human DNA contains more useless, functionless DNA than that of animals by far, because, of course, we're more progressed than animals. Junk DNA, defined as non-coding, that is DNA that doesn't code for protein formation. But watch this, because there are newer developments. Researchers are showing that the old Darwinian ideas about DNA were simplistic. So, welcome to the new genome. World Magazine, I think this was in 2012. New discoveries reveal that DNA is so important that they say, God don't make no junk. Not exactly good English, but I get the point. And scientists should have known this all along. They really should have. Here's an evolutionist who doesn't like this idea that DNA is being found to be functional. After all, he wants it to be junk. He says the creationists are going to love this. Larry Morin is his name. He says this is going to make my life very complicated. Dr. Morin is a biochemist at the University of Toronto. Richard Dawkins said in his book, The Selfish Gene, that non-coding DNA is like a parasite in the genome, fulfilling an innate evolutionary drive to survive despite its being biologically useless. Well, this has been completely disproven. So Dawkins had better go take a hike. As the evolutionary argument goes, why would a creator insert worthless code into a genome? Well, he doesn't. He's a creator, and he put very, very highly technical material in the genome. And Coe discovered that 90% of those supposedly inactive regions of DNA are fully functional, containing 4 million switches, turning genes on and off, controlling protein production and how cells behave. Tremendous. If certain switches did not get turned on or off, you might get some really weird genetic deformities. For example, a big toe growing out of your forehead. How would you like that? Well, or maybe a bat that doesn't turn out just right for evolutionists. Junk science, that's what they're involved with. As evolutionists themselves are now realizing, this is science fiction. And believe me, it's called causing a lot of friction out in the scientific community. It's not real science, not even evolutionary science. Creation scientists have been saying this for years. Take a good look at this. I will praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before even one of them came to be. Isn't that beautiful? You are a gift from God, not from evolutionary processes. Let's talk about gene expression. When you were born, well, you were born with a set of chromosomes containing DNA-laden genes. Now, this is going to get complicated. I don't mean to put you to sleep, but I hope you will watch a little bit here. The genes in these chromosomes determine your gender, stature, eye color, even your sensitivity to light and sound. 90% of your genetic material is made up of gene switches, which we are just beginning to understand. Little tiny switches. These switches change the way a gene works, called gene expression, like a smile or a grimace. Switches can be influenced by toxins such as alcohol or tobacco, stress, behavior, and diet, expressing themselves as they were intended to or not. We have a lot of fetal alcohol babies these days. That's because these switches got turned off while these babies were in the womb. Very, very sad. DNA 101. Let's talk very briefly about DNA. DNA's code is written in a four-letter alphabet, A, C, T, and G. And there they are, amino acid nucleotides, A, adenine, cytosine, guanine, thymine. Don't worry. Just remember there are four letters there. And the DNA is found in the nucleus of the cell. This is a single cell. Nuclear DNA, most DNA, is in the center of your cells. It is wrapped into 23 pairs of chromosomes with information from both mom and dad. Now, DNA from dad, there's a specific DNA from dad, which is men giving their sons a Y chromosome, which their daughters will not have. But there's also specific DNA, not in the nucleus, but what we call mitochondria, that's out here in the cytoplasm of the cell. That's the DNA from mom. The DNA in your cells, mitochondric, is exclusively from your mother. So it does hold clues to maternal lineage. That's why tomorrow we're going to talk about mitochondrial Eve and who she was or wasn't. DNA, genes, and chromosomes. I've already said this. There are these four basic building blocks. Genes consist of proteins and DNA. They are inheritable packets of information aligned in chromosomes, and they determine hereditary traits. Chromosomes occur in pairs. Humans have 23 pairs, 22 of which are similar, but the 23rd is an XY in males, XX in females. That determines gender. Molecules to life. Here's the way it works. Amino acids produce proteins and DNA, which become genes, chromosomes, and those produce organs and organisms. Isn't that beautiful? From bottom up. So DNA is like a computer program, but it's far more sophisticated than any software ever created. Who said that? Bill Gates. He knows a lot about computers, but he says DNA is far more sophisticated than any computer I've ever been involved with. Seeing the structure of DNA is just absolutely amazing. You start with building blocks. Here again are those four building blocks. You have DNA. You end up with chromosomes. Chromosomes are inside the cells. There's a chromosome. And these are what we call DNA snippets, or genes. I hope that helps a little bit. Chromosomes are long chains of DNA containing many genes, approximately 1,000 genes per chromosome in humans. Very, very sophisticated. So again, there you have chromosomes, there you have gene 1, you have gene 2, and this is DNA. Beautiful, isn't it? Absolutely beautiful. Well, there's the nucleus again. These are the genes, or the chromosomes rather, that you see inside the nucleus. And when chromosomes split, you have cell division. There comes a time when they split. Now, if you think we have all the chromosomes in the world and that we're the most sophisticated creatures in the world, well, we are, but we don't have the most chromosomes. Dogs have 78, mosquitoes 6, chickens 78, tomatoes 40, mouse 40, humans 46. Genetic information in the human nucleus would equal 1,000 books. And if you had one teaspoonful of DNA, it would be a stack of books reaching to the moon. Here's the Earth. There's the moon. Imagine that. Absolutely amazing. What's the probability of that first cell just coming out of nowhere? The simplest living cell could not have arisen by chance. The likelihood of life arriving through a chemical accident is zero. And you have these complicated cells. We have 100 trillion of them in our bodies. Here's a muscle fiber cell. Here's a hair cell, nerve cell, and so forth. They're all different. The adult body generates well over 1 million new cells per second because some of our cells are dying all the time. Every second you generate well over 1 million new cells. If you lined your cells up end to end, they would form a thin line encircling the Earth 3 times. Now, you can talk about how do you get this modern cell, and this is an evolutionary proposal, but none of it works. It's not even worthwhile looking at. The question is, how did that first cell form? Well, proteins come from DNA. Gene-coded instructions tell cells how to make proteins. There's a problem here. To have chromosomes or genes, you need protein. But you also have DNA. You can't have the one without the other. You need them both, and you need them at the right time and in the right place. And then you have protein folding. Proteins fold, and folding is one of the most challenging and important areas of investigation in modern biochemistry. If they fold enough, they'll form a little machine part. That's how you get these rotors out of proteins that form like rotors. What are the chances of getting a small protein 150 amino acids long? Well, what are the chances of getting heads every time a penny is flipped? What are the chances? Here they are. 2 heads in a row, 1 in 4. 3 heads in a row, 1 in 8. 8 heads in a row, 1 in 256. Getting a little more complicated here. 100 heads in a row, I don't even want to tell you what all that is. You mathematicians know those numbers better than I do. And the possibility of getting a protein from a mud puddle is totally, totally impossible. It just cannot happen. Well, how then? Well, you just get creative, that's all. Just bring in life from aliens, seeding on Earth from aliens, like Richard Dawkins is perfectly willing to accept. Francis Crick, co-discoverer of DNA's molecular structure, proposed that primordial life was shipped to Earth billions of years ago in spaceships by more evolved aliens. Well, life on other planets? Nobel Prize-winning cellular biology professor Christian Dedeuve said, "Life is an obligatory manifestation of matter. Its emergence was inevitable under the conditions existing on our prebiotic Earth." Life will occur wherever and whenever similar conditions exist. There should be plenty of such sites in outer space, plenty of planets where life could exist, perhaps as many as 1 million per galaxy. In fact, the universe is probably awash with such sights. Do you think this is honest? No, this is just blubber. The casual reader wouldn't know that these statements are not supported by a single experimental finding, not even one. What Deduve is saying here is based entirely upon his ideology, what he believes, not what he knows or has proven. Not at all. Well, what came before DNA? From Discover magazine, they say one day, well, they're saying living cells will soon be created. And when I put this together with Matthew 24, I read, one day false prophets will arise showing great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. Well, could it be that this hoped for creation of life could be one of Satan's ruses, one of Satan's ways of just tempting us to follow him? What if mankind could produce that first cell? That makes man the inventor, doesn't it? Rather than God. So here's a scientist. He says, if I can just synthesize, that is, create life here, then I'll have proven that no intelligence was necessary to form life in the beginning. So he's got all his machinery there. And here's an article in the in a paper Friday, January 2008, the Press Enterprise, that's in Southern California, says scientist makes life from scratch. If you look at this article, the scientist did absolutely nothing like making life from scratch. Man-made DNA, they say, will produce a tiny bacterium that will live and reproduce. So right there, they're obviously saying it hasn't happened yet, setting the stage for a profound milestone, the creation of life from scratch. That's what they're after. But rather than making life from scratch, these geneticists used pre-existing cellular machinery, a process cells use to repair their chromosomes, involving a lot of things, RNA, enzymes, the cells themselves. So they have all these ideas. Nice try, but where did those precursor chemicals come from? You've got to have the chemicals to do any of this. Chemicals present before the first living cells, chemicals present before the first living cells. Now, they have all these ideas, but this is not reality. We don't know that. So I say synthetic or pathetic. The May 21, 2010 Wall Street Journal said, humankind has potentially entered a new era in biology. For the first time, scientists have created a synthetic cell completely controlled by man-made genetic instructions. As one molecular biologist put it, this is literally a turning point in the relationship between man and nature. The new bacterial cell named Cynthia, synthetic Cynthia, is the result of a 15-year, $30 million effort by genetics pioneer Craig Venter. But what did these researchers really accomplish? Let's take a look at this. What Venter achieved is a technical feat that does not live up to its headlines. The team of 25 researchers used machines to synthesize the DNA of Mycoplasma caprocolum bacteria. So here already you have the start. They're getting this DNA from a bacterium. More than a million base pairs were sewn together using yeast. Now, again, they're using living structures and E. coli bacteria. Is that creating life from scratch? I don't think so. However, the DNA they manufactured was an exact copy of pre-existing DNA from a living strain of bacteria. They then transferred these synthetic cloned DNA segments to a type of yeast. Again, here you have a living yeast that can accurately copy long DNA sequences. Big words, I'm sorry. Finally, the researchers transferred the laboratory-produced yeast clone DNA into a living bacterium that had its own DNA removed. Again, you've got a living bacteria. You're using the shell of the bacterium. And the resulting cell grew and multiplied. So is this a genuinely synthetic cell or just some pathetic attempt at creating life? And this is what it is. While achieving a significant technical feat, they did not create a cell from scratch. They assembled a genome from chemically produced DNA snippets, placed it into a cytoplasm and wall of a living cell that already had the molecular machinery required, carrying sugars, copying DNA, on and on and on. But they did not create a living cell. So I came upon this life out of life. As James Joyce, an Irish novelist and poet, once said, to live, to err, to fall, to triumph, to recreate life out of life. I don't really know why she wrote that, but that's not what's happening today. Life out of life? Well, that's the only way it works. God gives us life, and life reproduces life. So you can get life out of life, but it requires God. The human genome, though seemingly intelligible, is much more complicated than had ever been expected. The whole assemblage shouts intelligence and design right down to the individual proteins. The information making a person unique is written into DNA. If it were a book, we already said what a huge book that would be. It would take 11 years to recite the whole 10,000 pages just within the human genome, let alone all the other creatures and plants out there. The problem is, even having the letters in the right order, the pages can still be scrambled, resulting in genetic malformations and diseases, which is happening today much more frequently than many years ago. In the beginning was information. Information is not a property of matter. That is, matter never acquires information on its own. Created kinds remain kinds because of the information written within them. That's why those of you who saw that little video realize that kinds can't become kinds. And really, those evolutionary professors know it too, but they won't admit it. And that's because of the information that produces kinds. Kinds remain kinds. All life forms contain DNA with its encoded information, the highest known density and complexity of any informational data bank in the world. Information implies intelligence. Intelligence requires a source, a designer. Since the information in DNA far exceeds natural causation, there has to be a designer. The complexity is awe-inspiring. It is just amazing. When studying DNA, the letters are arranged in a specific way. Statistics, words, or sentences. Like the words and sentences in any book, we call that syntax. They have meaning. We call that semantics, conveying a written message. D-O-G for dog, C-A-T for cat, B-A-T for bat, M-A-N for man, and a dog doesn't become a cat, and a cat doesn't become man. That's because of the written code. But DNA isn't just there. It does something meaningful. We call that pragmatics or action. Meaning, however, denotes purpose. The words are getting bigger. Apobetics. I had never heard that until I started reading. Purpose. Is it really such a stretch then to read G-O-D in all informational pathways? I don't know how else you'd get those informational pathways without God. There's absolutely no way for matter to develop information on its own. Even Richard Dawkins knows this. He won't admit it. Pit bulls and humans? Moving from one kind to another would require real links, not just missing links. Living cells are computerized information banks. Pit bulls, for example, are prisoners of their own genetic code. They act like pit bulls because they're coded that way. They're pit bulls. As in a sense are we. Now, we're not pit bulls, but we are also coded to be what we are based on our DNA, genes, and chromosomes. So we're not pit bulls. We're humans. And God created a special language in our DNA. Well, did animals become human beings? I'd like you to take a look at the complexity of the human ear and eye. Look at these. These are rods and cones. What you're looking at here is a cross-section through the electron microscope of the retina, the back of the eye. And we're going to talk about rods and cones and what they do. Magnificent complexity in each of these structures. Could a band of marching army ants spell out the word genome? Could tone-deaf amateurs perform an orchestral piece without instruments, scores, and a director? Not in a million years. Hence, Darwinian evolution is going the way of the Soviet Union. You can't get that kind of complexity all by itself. It just doesn't work. So what is evolution? Well, in its simplest form, evolution means change over time, needing no God. Neo-Darwinism implies upward mutations, natural selection, survival of the fittest, and the arrival of entirely new, not just species, but kinds. Everything happens by chance, and all creatures share a common ancestry. So you had a fellow by the name of Lamarck who said giraffes need to eat food, so they have to stretch their necks, and they pass their long necks off to their offspring, and that's why giraffes have long necks. But to have a long neck like that, you need a heart that has tremendous power, and you need arteries that don't burst with all of that pressure. And you need that special skin on the neck, or the whole thing will explode. It doesn't work just by stretching higher. I've stretched higher in life, and I can't seem to gain any height. The problem is long necks can be a problem. Giraffe straining its knees at a watering hole, easy prey for a lion. I happened to take that picture when I was in Disney World in Florida. Here's another picture I took of an ostrich towering above its food source. Hardly a convenient arrangement. Is there an evolutionary reason for ostriches to have these long, lengthy necks? I think it makes it more difficult for them to get their food. And furthermore, now a cougar could very easily kill that ostrich. Or the giraffe, for that matter. These are not evolutionary advantages, necessarily. They can be disadvantages. But look at the irreducible complexity that we see in the world. We all know what this is. Great horned owl, chameleon, chimp, all different eyes. Eyes are more complex than the Hubble telescope by far. The iris adapts for light. Here's the iris. The lens adjusts for distance. The retina senses light rays. You already saw a cross-section of the retina. And we were talking about retinal rods and cones. They detect color, depth, and shades. The optic nerve sends image messages to the brain. The eye-brain connection then corrects for inverted images. How many of you, when you were a child, could stand on your heads? Yeah, some of you could. I could. Did the room turn upside down? Well, let me ask you a simpler one. When you twist your head, do it right now. Does the room change? If you did that with a camera, it would be a little different from how you do it with your head. The reason these inverted images standing on your head don't look like an inverted room is because the brain corrects that. That is amazing, absolutely amazing. It corrects. Even the retinal blind spot is filled in by the brain. Eyes detect and track objects effortlessly. Eyes are also self-protective, self-cleaning, and self-healing. You think the Hubble telescope could do any of that? Not any way in the world. If you look at human blood clotting, we don't have the time. This is a whole subject in and of itself. You need three different cascades of blood clotting factors, or otherwise blood will not clot. If any one of these factors is missing, you're going to have a problem. Missing blood factors, blood will not clot. Common ancestry, did we come from apes? Did you know that the octopus eye is most like that of humans? Did you know that of all creatures, bees have the most complex communication system or language of all animals? Did you know that soybean milk is most like that of humans? Did you know that chimp DNA is much like ours? Does that mean we came from chimps or octopi or bees or soybeans? This makes no more sense than humans coming from bananas, as far as I can see. It makes no sense that we came from lower organisms. The fact of the matter is, a chimp is a chimp is a chimp, and it never really changes. They don't become human. Plant evolution. In the Cambrian, that is in the really lowest rocks, according to evolutionists, are the Precambrian. And then you have the Cambrian, where early life supposedly evolved. But there already you find the entire plant kingdom, including mosses, ferns, seed-bearing plants, and flowering plants. Just take a look at that for a moment. More phyla, that is, families, are found deep in the Cambrian than exist today, many now being totally extinct. right there in the earliest rocks. The fossil record shows that not one of the plant phyla is either the ancestor or the descendant of any other. It isn't just links that are missing, but whole chains. Take a look at butterflies. They defy evolution. The caterpillar's locomotion is by crawling. It spins a cocoon, becomes a mass of jelly, and emerges as a beautiful butterfly. But how could a worm that never leaves the ground evolve into a butterfly that flies without retaining the ability to reproduce another caterpillar? I mean, while retaining their ability to reproduce another caterpillar. I mean, that is an amazing cycle, life cycle. You can't get there through evolutionary means. It's too complicated. So much complexity, so little time. There's a tiny parasite that lives in the trachea, the windpipe of honeybees, living only for 2 hours. During this time, the male must find a mate. To find her, he uses tiny eyes, each having as many as 80 separate lenses. Can you believe that? 80 separate lenses in a little tiny creature living inside a bee's windpipe? The evolutionary problem is this. For something that lives for only 2 hours, where did such complex eyes come from and or a mate? And how about us humans? Where did we come from? There are over 19,000 bee species, but there is only one Homo sapiens, human species, only one, which should tell us something about our uniqueness. We are uniquely created. I am your creator. You were in my care even before you were born, Isaiah 44, verse 2. If God designed each of the 10 trillion cells in the newborn body, don't you think he cares about you? Of course he does. He cares deeply about each and every one of us in this room, deeply. Human beings are the supreme example of intelligent design and purposeful planning. In the real world, as we know it, dust never becomes DNA, not on its own. That cannot happen. Information simply becomes garbled over time, given the law of entropy, the second law of thermodynamics. The creation model, everything is degenerating because of the fall. Here's the evolutionary model. Everything has to get to be more complex. But that's not what you see. This is what you see. That's the second law of thermodynamics. And I don't think we have to go over this again. We've gone over it a couple of times. The first law, preservation of quantity. The second law, the deterioration of quality. Left alone, everything will decay. I don't know if you've ever left an old shoe out in the woods and come back 20 years later. That shoe isn't going to look like a shoe anymore. Even if it's never been disturbed, it will decay. Time is the enemy of evolution, not its friend. Evolution requires this, but these are the basic trends we see in nature. Everything is becoming less organized. The second law of thermodynamics says quality is declining in the universe. Stars explode, comets disappear, matter disintegrates, energy becomes less available, information becomes garbled, we have decay, we have extinction, we have aging and death. Here's a picture of the degeneration of the genetic code. DNA is a written code, but the code is deteriorating and not evolving. How many Methuselahs have you seen running around today? Do you know how old Methuselah was when he died? 969 years. Have you seen any Methuselahs around lately? It's a different world. Certain things just cannot happen in a fallen world because life isn't going up, up, up. Life is going down, down, down. And the other thing is, if you believe in evolution, there must come a time when you have something that's not quite human. The question is, how am I going to tie my shoes? For example, it's just one little example of dysfunctionality, but we don't see that in the fossil record. I hate to do this. The slime will get you every time. Global warming could be a gory end for all of us. No. You got it. If we came from the slime, here's Adam. Who cares if we pollute the ocean? Just do your own thing. If we came from the slime, it's perfectly normal to throw everything back into the slime, isn't it? Isn't that normal? Well, I guess that's one way you could look at it. Evolution is the bridge to nowhere. Evolutionists claim that chimp and human DNA are 99% similar, proving common ancestry. However, chimp and human DNA are proving to be far more different than claimed by the evolutionary spin doctors. Furthermore, the genomes of each are deteriorating, mutant genes resulting in birth defects, not evolution. Genomic deterioration is in fact occurring so rapidly that both chimps and humans are seemingly headed for extinction. Geneticists generally agree that the human genome is deteriorating, causing a famous evolutionary geneticist, Dr. Crow, to say, "We are genetically inferior to cavemen." And that's true. Our genome is not as sophisticated as the genome in those old, old people. They may have found their way into caves after the Tower of Babel, but they probably had a better genomic code than what we have. Countless animal species are extinct, and lacking supernatural intervention, human genetic entropy will result in the extinction of all humans in less than 100,000 years. If we go on at this present rate, the human race will become extinct. And this is not hopeful for evolutionists. The rate of human mutations due to altered DNA is phenomenally high, one for every cell division. The vast majorities of these are potentially harmful, not helpful, though our bodies do correct most of them, and that's the key. Our bodies can correct many of these mutations, not all of them. Since the dawn of humanity, there have been tens of thousands of bad human genetic mutations, 100 new mutations per person per generation. There are now, look at this very carefully, there are now more than 6,000 human genetic, we call those Mendelian diseases. Think about Down syndrome, that's just one example. 2 to 3% of newborn babies having visible birth defects. That's very, very sad. And they're visible defects. And that's because of a decline in the genome. The mystery of our declining genes has been studied extensively by plant geneticist, Cornell University professor of genetic engineering, Dr. John Sanford. By the way, he is a scientific convert to six-day creation. He's looked at the genetic code. He's become a six-day creationist. It's wonderful. According to him, entropy is like rust in your car. You may not see it, but it's there, and it's not good. We're dying because of mutational entropy, rusting out because of harmful molecular mistakes. This is deadly for evolution. It's evolution in reverse. Problem is, people will hold on to evolutionary ideas even when they've run out of steam. And they've run out of steam because of the weakness of the arguments never having been based on genuine science and responsible hermeneutics in the first place. People have been feeding on evolutionary lies for so long that they can no longer see the light. Blinded by unbelief, they might as well be hiding out in a cave. So darkening is Satan's influence on people's minds today in the evolutionary world. Christians have always recognized order and purpose in the universe. Accordingly, science arose and is always at its best within a Christian setting. But even the brightest scientists, whether from IBM, Apple, or any of these others, have not come up with a computer matching the human brain. There's a human brain. There are literally billions of neural connections in your brain, and that doesn't begin to explain how God's Spirit indwells believers. Compared with a 6-pound laptop, the brain weighs only 3 pounds. But man's brain is nothing compared with planet Earth and all of what's on planet Earth. And take a look at animals. We're kind of at the end of this. I know it's getting a little late, but this was going to be one of the longer segments. Take a look at animals, just for the fun of it. Some amazing animals. You have to ask yourself, are they because of design or because of Darwinism? Welcome to the desert. Cobras. Scorpions. Lions and adders, puff vipers, they're all different, aren't they? Isn't it amazing how they are suited to their environment, the desert? Mother eagles train their eaglets to fly by pushing them out of the nest to try their wings. Because the little eaglet flounders, she flies under it, rescues it, and carries it back to safety. See that? With her strong wings, and then off it goes. There's the little eagle. He was rescued, he or she was rescued. Isn't that amazing what nature does? They do that all by themselves. Who wrote that into them? Evolution? I don't think so. Migration of various species requires two abilities. Orientation, that is knowing the direction, and requires some kind of compass. And navigation, knowing when to change direction, like a GPS or some kind of map. These migrating birds have that in their brains. Isn't that amazing? I have a GPS in my car, or I wouldn't have found this church, maybe. But you have to pay something, and that has to be devised by humans. It's here. It's right there. And look at what it can do. Migratory creatures have both of those, by the way. Dolphins have sonar. That's something different. But you have these huge circle routes that birds will fly from here to there and back. And let's see what kind of distances are involved here. Banding of these birds has shown that migratory birds often return to the same tree to nest each year, showing similar loyalty to their wintering site on the other side of the ocean. Isn't that amazing? Could you do that? 5,000 miles, bristle-thighed curlew will migrate 5,000 miles. 8,000 miles for a short-tailed shearwater. Information and order. Information and order don't just happen. It takes God to create something new and different. Try locking yourself into a room sometime and saying to yourself, well, I'm not going to come out of this room until I've created something out of nothing. Try doing that. Well, hopefully you'll have brought your sleeping bag, a cell phone, and lots of granola bars, because you're likely to be there a while, like forever. So either science is open to God or it is closed to everything supernatural, including Christ and his miracles. Forward movement. As with any forward band, forward movement means organization. No new orders, no new structures, no new structures, no new creatures. So what is evolutionary science based on? Nothing. In street language, natural selection cannot code for the road. Try driving from L.A. to New York City with no vehicle, no map, no route, not even a destination, and you'll find out what evolution can do. We're going to end with this, Job's answer. But ask the animals, and they will teach you. Or the birds of the air, and they will tell you. Or speak to the earth, and it will teach you. Or let the fish of the sea inform you. Which of these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In his hand is the life of every creature, and the breath of all mankind.